From the Association of Registered Graphic Designers, this is the Design Thinkers podcast. For 25 years, the Design Thinkers Conference has been bringing together visionaries from a range of disciplines to explore creativity, the design process, and the future of our industry. Join our host and RGD president, Nicola Hamilton, as she digs into the archives and reconnects with past speakers about the talks and ideas that have shaped this flagship event.
In this episode, I sit down with the Paula Scher. Paula is one of the most acclaimed graphic designers in the world. Since 1991, she's been a partner at Pentagram New York, where her work for the Public Theater, the Museum of Modern Art, Shake Shack, and the High Line have become landmarks of modern branding. We talk about her early career, life at Pentagram, and how she's still designing well into her 70s.
Hi.
It's nice to see you. We're going to dive right in. You have had such an enviable career. I'm so excited to get an opportunity to talk to you about it. I want to know if you've always wanted to be a designer.
Well, initially, I didn't know what a designer was or even that there was a profession called graphic design. I wanted to be an artist. And in high school, I was the school artist. I used to make the posters for basketball games and proms and things I never went to. I still do. I still make posters and flyers for things I never go to. And I was the school designer, but I wasn't called a designer. I was called an art person.
I remember hearing you talk about being the school artist before, and that wasn't always the case. It took you a little bit of time to find that identity, yeah?
Well, when I was a little kid, I drew. And it was something I did pretty much my whole life, but when I was really little, I wanted to be a singer, dancer, and piano player and bareback rider. You know, I mean, that those were serious professions. But, you know, as I grew up in my early adolescence, I took courses at Corcoran School of Art in Washington. I used to take three buses from Maryland down into D.C., and the building was actually right across from the executive office building, the White House. And I would go down by myself on the bus, and I went into Corcoran, and I saw these people that did not look like my parents. They were beatniks in that particular time, and they all had long hair and wore black tights and, you know, sweatshirts and things like that. And I thought, I knew they were cool. I knew they were cooler than my parents.
And what were you going into Corcoran to do?
Make drawings and paintings. You know, they had art courses for kids who liked art. So I liked art. And I remember I made a chalk drawing of ballerinas, and I made a portrait of a woman there. And I would draw and paint all the time. Then I would start doing it in my room and then get in trouble because I would spill ink on the floor or some terrible thing I would do.
Are you still a messy artist?
I'm messy, period. I like mess. I like clean rooms in my apartment and very orderly. And then wherever I'm making the work, it's a mess.
So I know you best. I know your work best as a partner at Pentagram New York, but you lived a couple of professional lives before joining Pentagram. Can you tell me a little bit about the early parts of your career?
Sure. I moved to New York in 1970 from Tyler School of Art. I met my husband because I had my teacher, whose name was Stanislaus Gorski. He had called up art directors in New York for me to show my portfolio, because at that point in time, I knew I wanted to be a graphic designer. And I met with a book jacket designer who worked at McGraw-Hill. His name was Harris Lewine. He was actually quite terrific. And he asked me if I'd like to meet Seymour Quast, because he thought he might be interested in my illustration. Because at that period in time, I thought I was going to be an illustrator. I didn't really understand typography well. And the work was much more illustrative. And I met Seymour with my portfolio. And he was sort of instrumental at the very beginning of my career. And I learned a lot from him. And all kinds of very magical things happened during that period. Before I began being a designer, I had, as I said, I wanted to be an illustrator. And I went to see a publisher at Random House. So I went to McGraw-Hill and I met with an editor, and the editor told me that if I wanted an illustrated children's book, I should write one. This is in about 1971, very early time. So I said, okay, and I left and I went home and I wrote a children's book. And the children's book was about animals that lived in a brownstone apartment. And there were sort of cutaways in my illustration of where the animals lived on three floors. And the story was about a bear that was going to sleep for a winter, but a cat who wanted to be an opera singer moved next door and was noisy. So they had a fight and they went to the landlord and they started moving the apartments. And the whole book was done as a series of cutaways of the story. So in 1972, I brought the book back to the publisher at McGraw-Hill with the drawings and the stories. And he said, okay, I'll think about it. And he lost it. I never got it back. I never got back my original illustrations or the type copy of my story. And I was 21, 22 years old. And I said, okay. And then I got a staff job. And I got a staff job working inside Random House in the children's book department. And I had a little cubby hole and I was doing paste ups and mechanicals then. And I was a very heavy smoker in those days. And I was the only person on the floor who seemed to smoke. And there was an illustrator named Stan Mack. And he had come up and he used to go into my cubby to smoke cigarettes. So, you know, there's this little space and we'd be in there smoking away. And I told him about, he's an illustrator. He used to do the real life funnies for the Village Voice, really quite well known. And, you know, we sort of struck up a little friendship. And he said, I told him the story about the book I wrote and that the book got lost and this editor lost it and I never got it back. And he asked me to tell him the story of the book. So I did. And he said, if you let me illustrate it, I'll take it around the corner to Jane Fader at the other publishing house that was part of Random House. I can't remember the name of it at the moment. And he said, I'll sell it for you. And he did. So I gave him sort of a layout of where the animals lived and how they moved. And the book is called The Brownstone. It's still in print. It was a sort of a library edition book. It was picked. It's in all the United States libraries. And it was like a fluke out of nowhere, like meeting Seymour was a fluke. There were things that happened just very early in my life in New York that seemed magical. And then after I had worked at Random House for a year, I was very friendly with my boss, whose name was Herb Levitt, who actually used to work at Pushpin. And he felt bad for me because he was leaving to go and work at an advertising agency. And there wasn't a job for me there, nor did I want to work at an advertising agency particularly. So he had a friend who worked inside the CBS Records promotion department, whose name was Ted Bernstein. And he called up Ted Bernstein. He says, I have this assistant who's worked for me for 2 years. She's really terrific, but I can't take her with me. And I thought maybe you could find a job for her. And he did. So I left Random House and I went to work for Columbia Records in the promotion department, where I did ads and some posters. And I really didn't know anything about the business. And I learned it while I was there. And the art department was a wild place, really a lot of fun, very silly, crazy things going on. And I had worked there 2.5 years, and I wrote a book called Make It Bigger that actually describes what it was like working in that department, which was very hierarchical. You sort of orders to do a particular ad for a particular record on Monday, and then you would design it and work with a copywriter. I had a partner named Marty Picar, who was very funny and a really good copywriter. And we would sort of solve the ad problem in the morning on Monday. And then you'd clip the layout to a routing sheet and it would go around the company. And it would go to the first person who would make a change. And then you'd make the change and you'd give it back to them. And then we'd go to the second person and they'd start to make the change, but then it would be the end of the day. So it'd be the next day. And then you'd make the change for them and go to the next person and they would make a change as it worked its way upstairs. Now, these ads had to go into the music business trade ads, which were Cashbox, Billboard, and a bunch of other things. And the ads closed on Wednesday. So by the time you made it all the way up to the, you know, the president or whoever had to see the ad was going to close. So they took whatever they got because you had to get it into the trade publications. And then I realized the thing that was that I really didn't have to start designing the ads till Wednesday. And so they became much better because nobody killed the good stuff because they were out of time because they had to make the trades. And this was my first breakthrough about dealing with people and corporations and hierarchies. So after I had discovered this thing, we did some very good work. And there was an art director at Atlantic Records who saw the work, and he also had advertising and he wanted to hire me for it, except for his department had advertising and record cover design in the same department. So I went to work at Atlantic and I made 25 covers in the first year I was there, and some of them won awards. So the art director of CBS Records in the cover department hired me back to be East Coast art director. And then I stayed there another 8 years. I made about a mile of record covers. I would produce about 150 album covers a year. Some of them were completely my design. Some of them were things that came in from Nashville that I had to move around and do something to. Some, you know, they were from all over the place. Some of them live on. You know, I mean, it's sort of amazing. You know, in record stores, all my team collect them. They find them and they say, "Look what I found." But that was a big part of it. That's how I started. And I became well known because I entered the work in design competitions and they got into design competitions. And then I became active in the AIGA and I was on their board and I was the youngest board member and the only woman for a period of time. And it was all, everything was seemed very accidental. You know, like I didn't have any great plan or scheme. I didn't even, you know, like I went to work in the promotion department in a record company. I didn't know anything about record promotion. I didn't have any experience in it. You know, you just sort of got there and figured it out.
It's so funny. You, in your Unit Editions published Paula Scher Works, a sort of monograph of your work. And there's a line in there that stuck with me for, I don't know, 6 years now. About how you felt like so much of what happened to you was happenstance. Do you really believe that it was all luck?
Yeah, I do. I, you know, not about whatever my abilities are. It was more the time. You have to realize that in 1970, the world didn't understand what a graphic designer was. Until really 10 years later, then and now everybody knows what it is. You hear the word on television, you know, but it used to be it was somewhere confused with commercial art. And commercial art usually meant advertising or things you saw on television and not actually the act of coming up with visual ideas and using typography. And initially, I was more of an art director than a designer. And I actually bought a lot of illustration in those periods, and then all the illustrators would get the credit for it, and I would be sort of annoyed. So the type started getting bigger on my album covers until I wiped away the illustration. And, you know, I mean, but it was as if one thing that happened for me was a result of another thing. And some of the things were accidental, and some of the things were decisions I made.
Do you remember any of those decisions, big pivotal decisions that you made?
Mostly it was when the record industry was in trouble. The record industry was really roaring when I worked for it. It was a recession. You know, the 70s were not a great economic period. But the record industry made money. And the reason it made money was because they would have hits and the hits would sell. But that isn't what made money for the company. What really made money for the company was selling their catalog. So in a way, you could say the record industry made money on technology because there would be, you know, first there was this, you know, albums were called albums because they actually came in an album. When there were 78 records, you would have to get three records to get the equivalent of one album. when the albums became 33 and a third RPM, if you remember that, I think that's recording per minute. They were the single records, you know, with labels on them, and they came in record sleeves. And then, of course, they became CDs, and then they became invisible and gone forever. And so there were all these different phases. At the end of my time at CBS, I left in 1982, and there was a crash in the economy, and records seemed to stop selling. Like, even hits were reduced in sales. And the industry had been gearing up for CDs, which were going to come. You know, and there were those really stupid plastic covers, because people perceived the technology was very important and really had to be protected. But you could throw one across the room and you wouldn't damage it. You know, like, I mean, like, everything is sort of hyped for that moment in time when they were going to sell these things. In the 2 years before it actually changed, and the company was bad, I controlled what I did by designing covers that were largely typographic and used found art, and constructing things myself, and not either commissioning photography or design. And I began to find my own graphic language. And that was a result of the economy and what was about to happen in the record industry, not because I had a grand plan that I was going to do this thing. There was a condition, and I responded to the condition. And in 1982, I left and I founded my own company with somebody I went to school with named Terry Coppell, and it was called Coppell and Share. And that was a whole other chapter.
I remember you saying something maybe to Debbie Millman about founding the agency because you wanted to design something that wasn't square.
That's right. I was really sick of doing record covers. I made a mile of them. Now I'm mystified how I could even be sick of them. I really love them. I love that they are really still a part of my life, that people ask me about them, that they know about my career there. I mean, I got this questionnaire from somebody was publishing a book on Cheap Trick, and I had done, I think, 5 or 6 record covers for Cheap Trick, and they wanted me to write a little essay on my favorite song. And I never listened to any of the albums. I just... I mean, I didn't necessarily like the music that I did covers for, but I did like the recording artists. I had worked with a jazz musician, and at this point in time, I hated fusion jazz. Now I really love jazz, but I worked for John McLaughlin, who at that time was sort of a Hare Krishna guy. His name was Mahavishnu John McLaughlin, and he'd come into my office with robes and cymbals and stuff like that. And he would close the door and make me listen to a 2-record set. I would just go, no. And then about, 2 years later, he had disappeared from the scene. He came back wearing a black leather jacket, had long hair that was no longer shaved, looked gorgeous, and said, I'm into materialism. And that would be the sort of thing that would go on a daily basis, sort of silly stuff like that. It was quite wonderful.
I guess that is some of the magic of graphic design, is the creatives and artists we get to surround ourselves with and the sort of corners of culture we get to participate in.
Well, that was unusual. I mean, I didn't experience that again later. I began to experience a business world that was different. But the residue of what was left is kind of phenomenal to me. I mean, I had done this series of records for a jazz artist named Bob James, and they became sampled. They weren't popular when I designed them. The record covers were, but not the records. And they were all large-scale objects blown out of scale. And like, there'd be a big football or a fried eggs or grapes or something, and they'd be the whole record cover. And hip-hop artists started using them. They'd sample them for, you know, their backgrounds and their music. And Bob James, I think, is the second most sampled jazz musician that was used. And that's, I think, how Rick Rubin and I, that's how he knows me, I think, initially. I mean, we became friends later. But that there was this thing about the covers that, so now kids who know them don't call them by their titles. They call them, oh, is that the matchbook, or is that the football, or is that? And that's how you think about them.
It's so fascinating to think about. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about Koppel and Schur. So you then run Koppel and Schur. So then you run this agency. You've never done that before. You were working in-house at record companies. What's that experience like?
Well, I couldn't do that now, because at the point in time we did it, the industry wasn't as sophisticated or as competitive as it is. We didn't call things branding. We called them identity. We were designing. Terry was a magazine designer. I had been a music business designer. I began getting youth culture business. I did the first ad campaign for Swatch Watch in the United States, because it was sort of hipster stuff. You know, like if you were talking to a young audience, that became something where I was viable and people would call because they knew I'd done record covers. I also began working for a record label called Manhattan Records that the former president of CBS ran out of Capitol Records. And I, for about 3 years, I did their covers. So I was doing record covers, book jackets, and ads. And Terry was doing magazines and books and some other editorial stuff. So we had a very viable business until about, I would say, the late 80s, you know, like maybe after 1986, there was a really bad George Bush senior recession that went on in the States. And Terry didn't have a magazine to design for over a year. So he finally took a job at Esquire, and I was left running the business alone and sort of hobbling through. Also, we had, right before the recession, we had we'd moved moved into this sort of very big, beautiful loft space that we renovated that was very expensive. And he left, and I was sort of handling the debt and trying to pay things off. And, you know, I had enough work to manage, but it was really very marginal, and it was quite hard. And one day, magically, Woody Pirtle, who was an American designer who I knew and admired, came over and asked me if I would like to join Pentagram.
What do you know about Pentagram at that point? How connected are you to what's happening at Pentagram?
Well, I knew a lot about Pentagram because Seymour knew them. And I had met Colin Forbes, I think, when Seymour took me to AGI, which I'm very active in now. But I went as a wife the first time I went to a meeting. And I knew who Alan Fletcher was and liked his work. The other ones, less so. I met John McConnell socially. By the time I joined Pentagram, I think I knew everybody a little bit. Like, I knew David Hillman a little bit. And so there had been social things, but that was mostly through Seymour, not through my own reputation, though they knew who I was because of the record industry. I had a lot of work published in design magazines like Rafis or CA or Print Magazine. So I was a visible person, and I was rare because I was a woman. The only other woman who was really visible at that time was April Grimen. And we became friends. We never were on the same speaking circuit because they would only invite one woman. There would be a panel of four men and there would be one woman. And if it was on the East Coast, it was me. And if it was on the West Coast, it was April. And we met each other at an AIGA conference because we were sitting in a very long line of speakers. And I heard her name and she heard my name. And we bent over and we sort of waved at each other, you know, under these knees of these men in line, which was sort of fun. We're still friends.
That's amazing. But I mean, talking a little bit about how few women there were who were visible in the industry, you were the first woman to be invited to join Pentagram as a partner.
Kit Heinrichs in the West Coast office, his wife was a partner for a while, but that actually was tricky. And she was not asked on her own. It was like she came as a set, and that fell apart. But I was the first individual woman to join.
And then what do those first few years at Pentagram look like? How do you join? It's you as one of a woman on her own in the New York office. How does that shake out?
Well, first of all, my friend Michael Beirut was asked at the same time. He joined first because he left. He had, once he decided to join, he had to leave Massimo, who's working for Massimo Vignelli. And he had to leave and get out of the office because he couldn't hang around there, you know. And then after Massimo knew he was doing this. So he joined 6 months before me. I had to close down the Coppell and Chair business and, you know, get rid of the space and do a lot of stuff but before I could join. But he was there. And Woody Pirtle was a friend of mine. So that was warm. Like there was some support system in that. And I had asked my friend Jim Bieber to see if he wanted to join because he was a terrific architect. So it, for a period of time, the original partners who were in the New York office were Colin Forbes. And he was there with one other partner named Peter Harrison. Then Woody joined, and then Michael and I joined, and that became the New York office and Jim. Then over time at Osmose, Colin, and I think the first year I was a partner, half of the partners had resigned. I mean, Alan left the first year. I knew Alan. Alan was one of the partners I knew the best because he was a friend of Seymour's. Alan left the first year. And then Colin left and Mervyn Kurlansky left and Theo Crosby left. And they, you know, all of a sudden it wasn't the same group.
Why were they leaving?
Because their age or where they were in their position in life. You know, Pentagram is an evolving place. And some people come and go. For example, Peter Saville was a partner for a year and it was a disaster for him. And, you know, he's an individual and he should be on his own doing his own thing. But he was in the London office and it absolutely didn't work out. And I cried when he left. It was just because there are generational issues, you know, and it's not for everybody. And sometimes you fall in love with the work or you fall in love with the person. But in the end, the person has to be able to adapt to the condition. Of what the place is, and what the place is about is you have to be collaborative with the group on things that concern the overall place, and that you're an individualist in your work. You have to be able to run a team. You have to manage your own profit. So it's being an individual in the place. Alan Fletcher once described it as like a pile of birds on a wire huddled together for warmth. But then they fly off and do their own thing.
I've heard from a few people that the first couple of years of getting established at Pentagram can be a real slog, the sort of imposter syndrome of the people that you're working with, for some folks starting to run their own studio if they haven't done that before, because you are managing the profit. Were you able to bring some of the things from your agency, some of the clients into Pentagram?
Yeah, but they were low-paying clients. They were mostly book publishers and things like that. But in my first 2 years of Pentagram, the first year was really rough and I was essentially working off my own business. And I was also paying off debt because I had debt on my office. And then all of a sudden things began to change. I didn't believe it was going to. It actually takes 7 years to just to adjust to the system, but my work changed because there was a woman who was at the Bard College for curatorial studies. And she hired me to do an identity for her and liked working with me. And her best friend was a woman named Ellen Futter, who was the new president of the American Museum of Natural History. So I began designing identities just really through one connection. And then I did a redesign of the Sunday Times magazine through Janet Froelich, who became the art director there. And then right after that, I'm trying to remember all the things that were that year, came the Public Theater. So I joined in 1991 and I designed the Public Theater in 1994. So there was a 3-year period. But when I did the Public Theater, that was like all over town. And that sort of was my breakout piece of work.
I mean, and it still is a project that you're so well known for and is so fun to have watched evolve. And I was taught about it in school as a way to sort of see an identity grow and morph with the times. Those kinds of long-term client projects, what do they bring to you as a designer working on something consistently for that amount of time? It's been 30 years with the Public Theater.
Yeah. This year, they couldn't, we're redoing the Delacorte Theater, which is the theater in the park. So we did all these animals because they were like little mascot animals because they're having a series of plays in other places because the Delacorte's closed. And so that was sort of charming. I chose to stay with the public theater. What happened was I was hired by the theater director, George Wolfe, and the theater had one bad period where it almost collapsed financially. And he sort of pulled it back, but he had had it. And then another director came in. And the other director didn't hire me. And I felt like, oh, this is never going to work because that generally doesn't work. The other director is Oscar Eustace, who I've been working with now three times longer than I was with George Wolfe. But I decided to not charge for it. I thought, I'm going to keep this because I know how to do it. And if I can just do one thing and grow it, then I'm in control of it and I can see how far I can push it and what I can learn from it. So I used it like a science project. And, you know, I love the people at the theater. I'm sort of an institution there now. So nobody messes with anything. It's the season. I do the season. I show it to them. I explain how it's going to work. They're always happy with it. And then now there's an in-house art department there that can execute most of the things after I've designed. It's sort of like designing the identity system and then somebody else executes it for the year.
I remember you've spoken before about sort of seeing somebody else execute the system each year and the kind of terror and magic that comes from watching someone else execute your design system.
Well, sometimes they do it really amazingly well. And sometimes last year, we did something different last year. And I think the execution wasn't as good as the other projects that were more consistent with the typography. Last year, we did something that was actually much more illustration based. But this year, we also used illustration, but I see they're working with it better. And I think it's because it isn't hand done. The year before, it was very sloppy. It looked a little punk art, I guess. I don't know. But I liked it. The poster and the graphics for the park period worked very well in that system, but the rest of it didn't. And sometimes the poster for the season isn't very good, but the execution of it for the other stuff is better. You know, like it sort of goes back and forth. But I think the mistake was that you had to be a bit of an illustrator to do that.
Yeah, and that doesn't fit everybody.
No. It's all right. Just one season.
Here's Paula on the Design Thinker stage in Toronto in November 2023.
3 weeks ago, I had my 75th birthday. And that is not even distinctly near middle age. So, you know, we live, particularly in the United States, is a territory of incredible ageism. And which was something I had begun feeling, I think, as I was turning 70. And I had to decide what I wanted to be doing because I really have two directions I could go in because I'm a designer and a painter. And both, I still do both things. And I thought, well, I can always move up to Connecticut full-time and be a painter and be a painter and be in a room all alone, all alone, all alone, with nobody around, nobody to laugh with, except for my husband, who is even more, has his nose in his drawing table than I do. So I thought, well, there's no reason I can't continue to work. And I began to think of this thing I showed once at a design lecture, which I call the design career staircase. And I just, for those of you who are very young, this is what you have to look forward to. And for those of you who aren't so young, you'll see yourself in this. In your 20s, you're either a peon or a wunderkind. Essentially, you're just being hired, you don't know anything, so you don't have any power. Or you're somebody who just breaks all the rules and turned into a complete star in their 20s. I knew Neville Brody in his 20s, and he was a wunderkind, and then he hit fallow periods. That happens. Everybody, it's sort of interesting how equalizing a design career is. But in your 20s, I always saw these career steps as a surreal staircase, where initially the risers are very high and the steps are very shallow. And that's because you learn things when you're young and you learn a lot. And the reason you can learn so much is you don't know anything. By your 30s, you're a pro. You've learned all the things you know in terms of how a business operates, how to talk to clients, how to make things, how to work with the latest technology, and you're hitting this stride where you begin to have bigger projects, more responsibility. Sometimes you get famous, sometimes you just do beautiful work, and life feels very good. But if you notice, the steps are longer and the risers are more shallow. In your 40s, you're an aging pro. You find yourself, particularly if you were in a youth-oriented industry, competing with people who are 10 years younger than you. And that's very disconcerting. But your 50s are different. In your 50s, you actually have power. And that doesn't mean it's because you turned 50. It's because everybody you knew in the first 30 years also turned 50. And they have power, and they can actually begin to think about hiring you at a much higher level. If you think about it carefully in terms of your own experience, you'll find this is relatively true. I mean, not all things are exactly as I've put it, but in most instances and most people I've met throughout the times, this has been true. The 60s is really a continuation of the 50s, and it's largely because it becomes harder to grow because you know too much. And you have to force yourself to make mistakes in order to push yourself forward. But here you go. Yep.
What everyone's laughing at here is the line chart that Paula's been plotting has started a steep descent that's labeled 70s, total decline. And it hits the bottom of the chart where it's labeled 80s, lifetime achievement awards, and or death. Do you map your own career in decades like that? Do you think about it that way?
No, I just think about it in retrospect. You know, I mean, the thing is that there are significant changes, and the changes are really based on what you know and what people's expectations are of you. And that, you know, when you're young, you don't know anything. So if you don't know anything, you're going to learn a lot. So that's why you grow so much in the first 10 years, because you don't know anything. By the time you're 30, you know more. And so you're sort of moving along on a much more plateau level, though you're still usually getting raises or getting more important jobs or getting jobs that are more influential or learning your craft or whatever you're doing. And the thing about that is some of that's not always true. It's really based on luck. But what happens in your 40s, and I know this very much happened to me before I joined Pentagram, is that you start not getting hired for youth-oriented jobs. So that youth-oriented jobs are fun to do. They tend not to pay very well. And so you need things that pay more money. And the clients that you have start hiring younger designers who were the same age you were when you started working for them. So you have to kind of redefine yourself. This is generalization. It doesn't happen to everybody, but I've seen it sort of spread that 40 is for people who did youth-oriented things or book jackets or things that are sort of have a fast turnaround. It's harder for them moving from 40 to 50 unless they find themselves in a position of really being believed as a design guru and consultant, and you get bigger projects. And then that Pentagram is very good for that. And most of the people who join Pentagram join between 30 and 40 or early 40s. Because that's the point in time. That's the point in time. Pentagram is the best option.
What was your best decade?
I don't really know. I think that I did, the work I did in my 50s through 60s was probably the most lucrative and powerful visible work, but not necessarily my best work. You know, I mean, the work I did that was, you know, for corporations and things like that was like that. But the thing was, I also did a lot of cultural work then in about a space of about, I remember from 2000, from 2000 to 2015, I did so much New York culture. You know, like I did the design, the High Line. I designed the New York City Ballet. I designed the Metropolitan Opera. I redid a communication system for MoMA. I was doing the Public Theater all the way through it, and other things that were sort of more transient. But there was a lot of it. Oh, Bloomberg. Bloomberg's headquarters. I designed the New York City beaches and the boardwalk and the Rockaways after Hurricane Sandy. I mean, they were like, there was sort of one great project after another that was highly visible and terrific.
Yeah. Okay. So if your 50s and your 60s were really good decades, what's been the most challenging decade?
Now.
Okay. Let's talk about that. How come?
I'm an old lady.
Still making incredible work. On the Design Thinker stage this year, your talk was called I'm Not Done Yet, and you only showed work that you've made in your 70s. And there was so much of it and so many good ideas.
Harder to get. First of all, it's the industry changed a lot because I think it's actually, Pentagram's actually in a funny way in a dangerous position because so many of the firms that we compete with are capitalized by other advertising agencies. And so that you have designers who might equally easily be partners of Pentagram, but they actually don't choose to be anymore because they're subsidized. Like if you work at Wolf Olin, you're not getting the work. They're getting the work. And, you know, they have the strategists and the background for support, where Pentagram is just a band of individual designers who are working together without that kind of support. So you find yourself competing with firms like that, or you're competing with younger designers who can work for less money than you can. So it's sort of a bad middle position, sort of what I'm seeing. It doesn't mean that we're not conquering it, but I think that the model may change. I think the model may change due to technology. I mean, I can see what AI can do. I mean, I just did a project using AI where it was a government project, and it enabled them to have a website that can sort of revitalize itself and has its own illustration system that is done on Midjourney through a series of five prompts that we gave the machine, and it can create all these icons and things that you want it to do. And that was really, that's going to change it, because it probably eliminates about 7 jobs, which is terrible on the one hand. On the other hand, if you know how to work with the equipment, you can do incredible things that are actually in places they're needed. I mean, if you look at what the government puts on their websites, they're terrible, you know, so this is a way of making them be able to do better things that people would likely read, which was good. I think a good thing to be doing.
Yeah. So where do we go from here for emerging designers listening? What advice do you have for them? Where to focus their effort and energy heading into the industry?
Well, it's a really good question. I think they have to spend a couple years working with somebody they admire that they can learn from, just to get the sense of how the game is played. And then I think they're going to need to be facile with the technology of the moment. And they're going to do extraordinarily well. That's actually a triple threat for us. You know, if you master that, if you know how to see and you know how to think, and you can master the equipment, you can do as much as a big firm. You've got it all there in the programming of the equipment. You can animate. You can create artwork. You can create templates. You can manipulate copy. You can do all kinds of things. And if you have taste and sensibility and feel good working with that, you're going to do terrifically well, much better than a generation ahead of you. I remember there was sort of a lost generation when computers came in. When I joined Pentagram, we had no computers. And then there was this period where we all hated it because the computer couldn't do the things with typography that you could do by hand. So there was this, and even my students who came out of that period, I think, had a worse time with their career because they couldn't easily adapt to the change. But I think that if you're young and you're open-minded and you can see, meaning you can make scale relationships, you have ideas, you learn typography, you can be, you can have a very successful early career.
Yeah. There's still space for us amongst the robots.
Yep. No, the robots are operated by people. The robots do not operate themselves. They do not. They may be able to be operated remotely, but somewhere along the way is a person.
I think it's true, and I think it's important to remember that. I want to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about your painting.
I paint, and I think that's an other discussion, because it really is a separate vocation for me. I'm a graphic designer 4 days a week, and then I go to my house in Connecticut, and I make these very big, laborious paintings of maps. And I've done it for quite some time, about 15 years. Maybe you've seen them. There's a book published on.
That was Paula on the Design Thinker stage in 2014 talking about her painting. Have you always painted? You've always seen yourself as an artist by the sounds of it.
I was doing something else. When I was working at CBS Records, and before that, I made sort of joke art that were sort of, you know, fractured pieces. It wound up, there was an AIGA cover where I was asked to do a cover, and I remember I asked them, does it pay anything? It didn't. It was a pro bono job. I said, well, do you have money for an illustrator or photography or anything like that? They said, no. So I thought, okay, I guess I got to do this thing by hand myself. So I didn't want to have any expenses. So I painted a piece of chipboard and painted a map of the United States on the back cover. The front cover was the percentage of people in the United States who used Helvetica.
For the record, Paula has already told us how she feels about Helvetica on the Design Thinker stage in 2023.
I hate Helvetica. And I've hated Helvetica my whole career.
And that's, so there was a listing. I just made that up. You know, there's a listing. I figured, like, I made rules of what states of people used Helvetica and didn't. And then on the back, I painted a map. And then the map was a fractured map, and I left out Utah. And Utah was in the water, and there was like a dotted line going on. It's actually a very beautiful painting, I have to admit. It was painted with gouache on chipboard, and it really had beautiful. Right. And I thought I was just being witty, but it was actually kind of a beautiful object. So I was doing a number of these things, and they started getting bigger. I remember at one point I thought, you know what, I'm going to paint one of these really big, and I'm not going to make it a joke. And I began doing it, and that's how they started. And I was really in my 50s when I did that.
What do you get out of the painting practice alongside your design practice?
Oh, that's really important. It's the balance. I mean, a pentagram, everything is social. So, you know, I'm talking to my partners, I'm talking to clients, I'm doing things on the fly, I have a team, you know, like it's a social thing. And the painting is very solitary, and I can't do one without the other. I don't think I'd want to not be a painter. Right now, actually, I'm in a funny position because I have a bunch of commissions that I have to get done. And there's sort of a middle area because I have to paint, you know, things to a specific size or something that they want to have happen. So I'm sort of functioning more like an illustrator in a way, but they still look like my paintings. You know, there might be some information in there. But the thing is that I really think that they balance my interests. Like, I like the idea of touching something and having something tactile to work on the one hand. On the other hand, I need the social activity.
So it's a balance for you.
Totally.
Okay. Our last question. We're asking everyone we talk to the same question. This year's Design Thinker's theme is Into the Rabbit Hole. And so in the spirit of that idea, we're asking everyone what the last topic that really sucked them in was. What's the last thing you got really, truly lost in?
Well, this thing I was telling you about this government project, which has been really, really interesting for me because it was actually stuff I thought I wouldn't like to do and wouldn't want to do and couldn't be good. And in fact, I'm really fascinated by the process of what we made. We're going to put together a very big case study on it to show how we how we built this self-sustaining system. The biggest problem is really it was more than just what does this thing look like and how we use Midjourney or whatever. It was really the government itself. That what this thing is each division of government, like the Department of the Interior or the Defense Department or the every part, there are hundreds of departments, but the main ones, there are about 40. You know, there's the IRS, et cetera. They all have goals that they have to achieve in a course of a year. And they come out of, the goals are reported through the Office of Management and the Budget, which is really part of the President's office. It's the president is the manager, the CEO of the United States, and that there are lots of things that are achieved during the United States. Like Congress makes laws, and Congress also sets priorities, but very often these things are executed by the departments. There's a Department of Defense. That's where every missile is made. You know, I mean, that you have to consider that there are employees within the federal government that does these things. And the general public doesn't have any awareness of it. And they're always like yelling at one person like they're the government. No, the government is, I think it's something like 70 million people or something. It's huge. And, you know, there's state governments. There are all kinds of things. So what performance.gov did is that each department was supposed to make a report on what their goals were for the year and what they achieved or didn't achieve. And what happens is really interesting. I saw the reports they make, and they're really, really long, and no one's going to read them. And I believe some of that is deliberate, because if you make it long and complicated, no one's going to want to pick it up. You have to invest an entire day on reading something that could probably be. So anyway, we use ChatGPT to get to the gist of things and pull it down. Now, I can't use ChatGPT on a government program, because it could actually mean theft or that people could get into it. So we're going to build our own system to do the same function that you can't crack, because it won't be designed quite the same way. Anyway, that was one thing. It's like I'm starting to think about things like, how do you build these unique systems with this equipment that can do these things? Once you know they can do it, then because you couldn't do the ChatGPT, and we think people are going to push it off because the reason the reports are so long is some of it is to obfuscate information. Yeah, well, yeah, hide stuff and blah, blah. So what we did is we're working on another piece of software that cuts the copy at a certain point. Like the copy may be already cut through the ChatGPT, but if it's still too long, there's the system that actually character counts it and rewrites it so it fits into the report. And that was as much fun to try to figure out, how are you going to do this? Because you started dealing with designing human behavior. And that's very interesting. And so that, combined with how to create the digital images and make the rules for it, I really got obsessed with. It's been very fascinating.
Well, I can't wait to see it and to see that big case study.
Me too. We'll see if it ever even takes it out. I hope we can finish it while this administration is still in power.
I mean, that is always a challenge when you're doing government jobs, right?
Well, my brother worked for the government, and he used to be on a project, and then the administration would change, and they would just dump the project. That happened all the time. There's probably more waste in that than there is in the people that are working for the government. My God.
So wild. Well, Paula, thank you so much for sharing all of your experiences and wisdom with us. I really, really appreciate it. And I can't wait to see what you do in the next decade.
Me too.
AFIX is a longtime display sponsor of the Design Thinkers Conference. We share your love for art and help you bring visual excellence to your printed messages. Our modern poster displays are so versatile, you will connect with your audience in any space. We build truly eco-friendly product. We ship them locally and fast. Visit posterdisplay.com.
Design Thinkers is Canada's largest annual graphic design conference. Join us in Vancouver in May or in Toronto in November. Tickets are on sale now at designthinkers.com. Design Thinkers is produced by the Association of Registered Graphic Designers, also known as the RGD. RGD is Canada's largest professional association for graphic designers. Our vision is for a graphic design profession that is broadly valued for its contribution to life, commerce, and society. To find out more, visit rgd.ca.